Okay, so let us carry on with the Puttalia Sutta on the downside of the sensory world. So we have one simile at the very end here. We'll have a look at the simile and then we'll see what happens next. So this goes as follows. Suppose there was a dark forest grove not far from a town or a village. And there was a tree laden with fruit, yet none of the fruit had fallen to the ground. And along came a person in need of fruit, wandering in search of fruit. Having plunged deep into that forest grove, they would see that tree laden with fruit. They would think, that tree is laden with fruit, yet none of the fruit has fallen to the ground. But I know how to climb a tree. Why don't I climb the tree, eat as much as I like, and then fill my pouch? And that's what they would do. And along would come a second person in need of fruit, wandering in search of fruit, carrying a sharp axe. Having plunged into that forest grove, they would see that tree laden with fruit. They would think that tree is laden with fruit, yet none of the fruit has fallen to the ground. But I don't know how to climb a tree. Why don't I chop this tree down at the root, eat as much as I like, then fill my pouch? And so they would chop that tree down at the root. What do you think, householder, if that first person who has climbed the tree doesn't quickly come down when that tree fell, wouldn't they break their hand or arm or other limb, resulting in death or death-like suffering for them? Yes, sir. In the same way, a noble disciple reflects. With the simile of the fruit tree, the Buddha said that the sensory world gives little gratification and much suffering and distress, and they are all the more full of drawbacks. Having truly seen this with right understanding, they reject equanimity based on diversity and develop only the equanimity based on unity, where all kinds of grasping to the world's material delights cease without anything left over. So here we have this idea of a dark forest grove, yeah? And the dark forest grove is really the world of the sensory pleasures and the sensory objects, yeah? And the idea here, of course, is that it is a forest. It is thick, yeah? It is like a jungle thicket or something like that. You cannot see very far. You are hindered by all the trees and all the vegetation around you. You are kind of, you have no oversight, you have no overview, you don't really know what is going on very far away. Your vision is very limited. And of course, the purpose of what we're looking at now is to gain vision, gain clarity, to see things clearly. So it is dark and dense, and it's like you are trapped a little bit because you're unable to see very clearly. And this is kind of the point of the sensory world, that we are trapped in this. We can't really see very far. We don't have an overview. We don't have that perspective of rising above this, but we are trapped inside of it. So this is part of the simile, this idea of being enmeshed or engulfed or enveloped in this kind of darkness without seeing clearly what is happening here. And then as you kind of wander around this dark forest grove, yeah, you're wandering around in search of the nice pleasures of the world, yeah, of whatever it might be in that realm, entertainments and relationships and all that kind of stuff. And then you come to a tree, yeah? You come to some delightful sensory pleasure, whatever that might be. And you kind of think, yeah, let me climb that tree. And then when you climb the tree, it's like you're grasping onto this sensual pleasure, in a sense. And then you start indulging. Yeah, you go up the tree, and I don't know what kind of fruit is there, some marvelous fruit, some beautiful mangoes, something like that. I usually think of mangoes, because everyone likes mangoes, I reckon. So you go up that tree, you have some beautiful, just ripe mangoes. And then, of course, what happens is that you become intoxicated by that fruit. Yeah, you keep on eating. You know what it's like when food is really nice? It can be intoxicating sometimes. You lose your sense of perspective, sense of what is going on. And this is a problem, because when we are intoxicated, whether that intoxication is by sensory pleasures of the world, whether it is by alcohol or drugs, whether it is by all these other things that can intoxicate us. Yeah, in the suttas they talk about the intoxication of health, the intoxication of youth. Yeah, or when you kind of forget yourself and you do all kind of silly things because you think, yeah, I'm healthy and whatever, and you kind of. So intoxication is much more than just alcohol in the suttas, and one of them is sensual pleasures, indulging in things. Because when you indulge in these things, you lack clarity of mind. You don't know, you forget what is actually important in life. And when we are intoxicated, that's when we start doing silly things. Yeah, we start misbehaving because of that. We think these sensual pleasures are more important than anything else in the whole world. And because they matter so much, we are willing to compromise our ethics to indulge in those sensual pleasures. And this is what's happening with this fellow in the top of the tree. Yeah, he's indulging, he doesn't know what's going on. And then this other guy comes at the bottom and he says, yeah, I'm going to chop down this tree. And the simile here is that suddenly death just comes upon you. Yeah, suddenly the great dangers of life become apparent, and the tree might fall over, you might die out of the blue. And because you are intoxicated, you don't really understand what is happening. Yeah, suddenly, bang, oh, I died, what happened? Yeah, jeepers, I wasn't ready for this. You know that, how many people are usually ready when they die? Everyone says, oh, I didn't expect this to happen, it happened so fast. I hear that almost every time someone dies. Yeah. Oh, it happened out of the blue. Happened so fast. This gives you the reasoning behind that. Yeah. I didn't expect it. We should always expect death. We should never be surprised when it happens, because this is exactly the point. It never happens when we want it to happen. It happens when it happens. So we have to be aware. We cannot really afford to be intoxicated. We cannot afford to mess around in that world and do stupid things, because suddenly death comes, and then it is too late. So this kind of brings in a little bit of death contemplation into the danger of being intoxicated. Yeah. So then, you know, when you kind of hear the axe being pulled out of the bag, yeah, you hear the chopping, you think, wait, what's going on? It's like this is the Devadutas, the divine messengers, yeah? As they talk about in the suttas, the divine messenger being seeing the dead person, seeing the sick person. It's a reminder. Wait, hold on. What's going on here? There's something bigger. There's a bigger picture here to be kept in mind. Yeah, and then you clear, your mind clears up. The intoxication leaves you. And then mindfulness gets reestablished and think, yeah, okay, I have to live well. Living well is what it's all about. And then you come back to the things that are important in life. So this is the idea of avoiding being intoxicated by the world. But to really understand that grove, yeah, the grove of the sensual realm, and to understand what it is all about and not to be intoxicated, the only way to do that is really to elevate yourself out of that grove. And of course, the way that is done in the Buddhist teaching is through meditation practice, through samadhi specifically. Samadhi is when you kind of emerge from the sensory world for the first time. And when you emerge from the sensory world, and it's almost like you are kind of, you know, it's like you're lifted above the sensory world. Can't you build up the good qualities of the mind? The mind becomes bright and light. And it's like you are soaring. Yeah, it feels like you're soaring in a sense, because the mind becomes so beautiful. And that's when you soar. And this is kind of all metaphorical, of course. But when you soar like that, when you go up in a balloon, you get the bird's eye view. And then you understand what is going on. Because you can see the sensory world from the perspective of above and understand what is happening. Yeah. And this is what you find in the suttas. Yeah, you find this kind of idea in the suttas with a famous simile of the two friends. There's a simile found in Majjhima Nikaya 125, the Dantabhumi Sutta, the level of the tamed. And it's a sutta of these two friends who are kind of walking along in the jungle, in the forest, and they don't see what's going on. And they come to a hill. Yeah, and the one friend says to the other one, oh, let's go to the top of the hill. And the other one says, nah, it's too too hard work to go to the top of the hill. There are all these meditation retreats. Oh, too tough. Yeah, keeping precepts. No, I'll just stay below and enjoy my sensual pleasures. Thank you very much. But the other friend, he goes to the top. Yeah, and when he goes to the top, he looks out. And when he looks out, he gets the bird's eye view. He sees the villages. He sees the paths. He sees the ponds, the parks, and all of these kind of things down below. So he shouts down to his friend. He says, "Listen. I'm up here. I can see all of these things. It's amazing. It's kind of astonishing. I can see all these parks and beautiful things far away. I can sort of understand what is going on. Come up and have a look." And the one below says, "Nah, you know, it's too much hard work. I'm just going to, you know, hang out down here and just, you know." And then the guy on top gets a bit exasperated. Yeah, like the Buddha gets exasperated with people because they don't follow his advice. So he goes down and grabs his friend by the arm. This is what the Buddha tries to do with us. He grabs us by the arm, yeah? Tries to pull us in the right direction. So he pulls him up to the top of the hill, and he says, "Look, what do you see?" "Oh, yeah, you're right. I see ponds, forests, roads." "I just heard you say, that's impossible, you can't see those things. So what are you talking about?" "Oh, yeah, I was blocked by this big hill. The big hill was in the way, so I couldn't see it." And that big hill, of course, is here a simile for the five senses specifically, but also for the five hindrances, yeah? But from the five hindrances, the most important one is the first one, the sensory world or the sensory desire. That's the most important one. That blocked me. I couldn't see what was going on. Yeah, so the sensory world blocks us from understanding the sensory world because we are like fish in water. We have always been swimming in this world. We're always immersed in the five senses. And when you're always immersed in something, you have no clarity about it because it's always around. You don't really understand what is happening. Like the tadpole in water. But one day you become a frog. Yeah, one day you climb that mountain. One day you come to Jhana Grove and do a meditation retreat. Yeah, and then you start climbing out of that world. You start lifting yourself out of that thing that you've always been immersed in, always been enveloped in. And you start to understand the world in a different way. Yeah, it's like you soar above the ordinary world, but it's an inner soaring. It's a soaring that happens inside. And suddenly, you understand what is going on. Suddenly, you understand all this craving, all this desire, yeah, for things that aren't really worthy of the desire. First of all, the craving itself is problematic. Secondly, the enjoyment of those objects isn't that great. And this is what you start to see. And then you soar above that. "Now I understand." And then you have the opportunity to give it up as a consequence. So climbing a mountain is one of these beautiful metaphors for the idea of samadhi on the Buddhist path. So this is how you emerge from that, yeah? How you then learn about it, you understand what it is about, you get some kind of degree of insight into that world, and until you get to that point, it's very hard to really fathom what is going on properly. Yeah? So... yeah, so you quickly come down, and then when you see that, you have this beautiful, it finishes off in this beautiful way again, yeah? The simile of the fruit tree, yeah? You know that the gratification, a little gratification, much suffering and distress in the sensory world, and you see all the drawbacks, and because of that, you reject the equanimity based on diversity. Yeah, you reject that whole world. You leave that whole world behind. Equanimity based on diversity. You have equanimity, but you're still enmeshed in that world. And then you develop the equanimity based on unity, which is the jhana equanimity, the samadhi equanimity, and then you let go of all the grasping to the world's material delights without anything left over. So there you are. That is the simile of the last simile there. So please, if you like, you can reflect on those similes, see if they make sense to you. These similes are, I don't know, I have kind of, I do this, read these similes out all the time, and it takes time for them to really kind of penetrate and understand. And I often, when I do these kind of retreats, I often hear people say to me, "Oh yeah, this time, and now I'm beginning to understand. I've heard you teaching this for 5 years, now finally it's kind of starting to hit home." And it's always like that, yeah? Every year it's a bit deeper, and you feel, yeah, now it's working, yeah? And one of the reasons why I enjoy it is it has a similar effect for me as well. Yeah, this is kind of the great benefit of being a teacher. Yeah? You are the primary pupil when you are the teacher. So, anyway, now we have looked at the right view in regard to the sensory world. And of course, that right view goes deeper, as I mentioned before. It has to do with the very idea of I am. This is the deepest aspect of that right view. So because we're looking at dasana, the seeing, the defilements to be given up by seeing, I want to have a little bit more look at the idea of I am and the problem of that. And just earlier on, yesterday, we were looking at the various kinds of perceptions that we have to develop, the perception of impermanence, of non-delight in the whole world, and that. And now I want to look at one more perception from that sutta. And this is the perception of non-self in what is suffering. So you notice here that there is like a kind of structure here, if you like. You start off with understanding the contemplating the suffering of contemplating the perception of impermanence, or developing the perception of impermanence. Things are impermanent. Then you have seeing the suffering in what is impermanent, and then you have seeing the non-self in what is suffering. So this is how these three characteristics are related to each other, how they build on each other. We often talk about the three characteristics in Buddhism, the ti lakkhana. Characteristics is basically the nature of things, So the three characteristics are precisely impermanence, suffering, and non-self. But they are also related to each other in this way. So the kind of the most basic one is really impermanence. Quite easy to understand, the idea of impermanence, Suffering, a bit more difficult. And then non-self is the most profound one, because they kind of emerge in this way from each other. So let's see what the Buddha has to say about this in this sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, 7.49 on perceptions. So this is the very last of these seven perceptions. And this is what the Buddha has to say. It was said, the perception of non-self in what is suffering, because when developed and cultivated, is of great fruit and great benefit, culminating in the deathless, having the deathless as its consummation. For what reason was this said? So just briefly, the idea of non-self in what is suffering, why that connection? And you could also say, argue that seeing non-self in what is impermanent, that's equally valid. Because if something is really impermanent, if it is not steady, if it is not there, if it is unreliable, if it is out of control, then by definition, it is not a self. A self is something steady, something which is always there, kind of the essence of who you are. One of the nice translations of atta is essence, the essence of a person, the essence of a being, whatever that might be. So the Buddhism says, well, actually, look for the essence, you're not going to find it. It ain't there. So so this is one way of thinking about the connection between non-self, is to connect it with impermanence. But you can also connect it with suffering, because if things truly are suffering, or they are unsatisfactory in whatever way, they're not worthy to be called a self. Who wants a self that is suffering? My essence is dukkha. That's terrible, right? If your essence is suffering and you can't get away from it because it's always there. So this is another way of rejecting. It's like almost like a skillful means of rejecting the idea of a self, because you don't want to have a self that's suffering. It's bad enough to have a suffering that's happiness, because it's maybe not that happy after all. But suffering, it is really unbearable. So it helps you to reject that idea, because it's empty anyway. It doesn't actually exist. So it kind of moves you in the right direction. So that is why this perception works. It works on that basis. So for what reason what they said? When a bhikkhu, bhikkhuni, upasaka, upasika, often dwells with a mind accustomed to the perception of non-self in what is suffering, their mind is devoid of eye-making, mind-making, and conceit regarding this conscious body and all external objects. It has transcended discrimination and is peaceful and well liberated. So you develop this perception. You see things in the world as suffering. You see the suffering of the in impermanence of things, and as you do that, gradually the non-self gets established. While you do that, seeing the problems in the world outside, starting to see the problems in the world inside, as we have been talking about partially, we're going to look more at the world inside later on when it comes to the meditation practice and mindfulness of breathing specifically. You gain the non-self understanding there as well. But when you do this, then this is what happens. Yeah, the mind becomes devoid of I-making. I-making, what is that? Well, this is basically the kind of the building up of a sense of self. Yeah, you're creating an I. You're creating an identity for yourself. And of course, this is what we love to do in the world. Yeah, defining out who I really am. And then building up that sense of I through success in the world or through the a kind of relationships we have with other people and institutions or whatever. Yeah, we are something in relation to all of this. And we build up the sense of self through feeling good about ourselves and building up our self-esteem and whatever else. Yeah, the ego building that happens in the world and the identity building that we have. This is the I-making. And all of that becomes kind of irrelevant if there's no point in having a sense of self. If the sense of self is problematic, if it ultimately is all suffering, then of course that whole thing about building up an ego becomes kind of madness. Yeah, and you stop doing that because you realize actually it is counterproductive, but at least even more suffering. You don't create this I anymore. So what we're seeing here is three different ways of relating to this I idea, the me ideas, the I-making, the mind-making, and the conceit. Three different things. The first one is the I-making, where we build up a particular sense of self. I am this, I am that, I am the universal consciousness, I am whatever it is that we kind of create ourselves to be. This is the I-making. And the mind-making is just the, once you have that I, well, then you have the mind. Yeah, because once you have a sense of who you are, an identity, then there are things that belong to that I. You cannot have an I without things belonging to it. At the very least, the qualities that you take yourself to be, at the very least, that will be mine. Yeah, and then there will be appendages to that, things that you own. Yeah, beyond that. These things never come without kind of something holding on to it. Well, sometimes maybe they do if you have like a very pure state of consciousness. But normally in most states of consciousness, the mind also is included in the I-making here. Yeah, this is mine. This belongs to me. And then we gain this wrong idea that we can control things in the world. Yeah, if something is yours, it means that we can control. That's kind of the point of things being mine. Yeah, but like we saw before, the Buddha said, actually, this idea of mine is just an illusion. Things are really more like borrowed goods. They are something you borrow from nature for a while, and then it goes back again, and you can't really hold on to it. It is out of control. It is not actually yours in the way you think it is yours. Yeah, so this is the idea of undermining the I, the mind-making. Yeah, if it is all suffering anyway, if it is all problematic from a higher point of view, then why on earth do you want to hold on to these things? So you start letting it go. And the last one is the conceit, or pride or conceit, regarding this conscious body and all external things. And the conceit is just the basic idea, I am. You haven't actually done any I-making or mind-making yet, but the very basic feeling that you exist, this is the conceit I am. And that conceit I am, it exists in relation to something. Yeah, you have to be something. So there's no I am in relation to this conscious body and all external signs. Well, that's everything. Yeah, the conscious body is kind of our inner life, and all external signs, all external objects, well, that's the entire external world. So there's nowhere, anything, in any phenomenon, any experience that you can see as an I am. Yeah, this is kind of the very last thing here. And you may wonder, well, how about these external things? How can you have a relationship like I am to the external things of the world? Well, this comes from some of the ancient Hindu ideas. Yeah, the idea that the self and the cosmos are the same. Yeah, so the cosmos is like Mahabrahma, the great ground of consciousness in the world. Yeah, this is kind of one of these Advaita, what is called Advaita Vedanta, the non-dual Vedanta. Vedanta. These are the ancient Hindu, and it's not really Hindu, Brahmanical teaching that started out in India before the time of the Buddha, the Rig Veda, the Vedas, the ancient Hindu teachings. And from that, it developed these quite advanced philosophy, yeah, until at least the Buddha came around about, you know, the world and the self and the cosmos being the same. And when you die, it's kind of the self and the cosmos kind of, you know, they reunite, or they are united into one thing, yeah, and that's the kind of the Brahma. And so the universe and you are the same in a certain way from this point of view. And so this is how you can, I am, I can relate to also external phenomena in this particular way. It is not really external, it's just a kind of illusion according to that idea. So there is nowhere to find an I am. Yeah, even in the most refined ideas of consciousness or world, mind, or whatever you want to call it, I am, there's no such thing as I am according to this idea. So these are the standard three ways of talking about the I am, the conceit I am, the I-making, the creation of a sense of identity and ego, and then the mind-making, the ownership of things in that world. And you have transcended discrimination. Yeah, you are peaceful and well-liberated. And discrimination here, one of the ways of understanding this, and this is what the commentaries say in this particular point, and that makes sense to me, is that, you know, one of the discriminations we talk about in the suttas is the three kinds of conceit. I am superior, I am the same, I am inferior. These are the three kinds of conceit that the Buddha says that we should go beyond. And we all know about superiority conceit. Yeah, it's quite a common thing in the world. We probably know about inferiority conceit as well, the feeling less than other people. But Buddhism has this beautiful idea of the equality conceit. Yeah, is that kind of a nice idea, the equality conceit? I am the same, you're conceited. It sounds strange when you hear that. But it's actually, I think Buddhism is the only religion or philosophy that I ever heard of that has this idea of equality conceit. Because it is really impossible to have the idea of equality conceit unless you have the idea of non-self. It is the idea of non-self that makes this possible as an idea, the equality conceit. So you can see why inferiority conceit and superiority conceit are bad. It's obvious, yeah, because you start treating other people as inferior or superior, and you kind of have all this kind of positions and hierarchies and power and things going on, so it's obviously it's not a good idea. But equality is something we kind of worship, yeah, in large parts of the world. Yeah, it's kind of a modern Western ideal, at very least, kind of a European Enlightenment idea that everyone is the same. We are born equal. Yeah, the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. We are all equal. Was it? We are all equal in rights and something else. I should supposed to know this, but anyway, yeah. Rights and dignity or something like that. Yeah, the idea that we are the same. This is kind of a modern idea that is kind of now, I suppose, a kind of international idea. But Buddhism says, no, not really. We're not really equal, yeah. So what does this actually mean? And so what it means is that there is nothing by which we can measure ourselves. Yeah? Equality assumes that we can measure. Yeah, I can measure against you, and I can say, well, you're like this, I'm like this, so we must be equal, or better, or worse, or whatever it is. It assumes that there is a way of measuring. Yeah? But that is precisely the point in Buddhism. There is nothing to measure by, because there is no essence. We aren't anything solid. It's not like I'm like this. I'm actually like this now. Next moment, I'm like that. And the last moment, I was like this. And last year, I was completely different. And next lifetime, completely different again. So which one, which me, are you going to measure against which you? There is no measurement. We are these processes that are always changing. Yeah, and so when there is nothing to measure by, then there is, we cannot compare. We cannot say that we are the same in that sense. And that's actually a very beautiful idea, because what it means is that we can look at each other not as equal, but as kind of on the same footing in a much deeper sense, yeah, than actual equality. And this is the idea that we are always changing. Because we're always changing, it means that we have all taken these different forms. We have all been doing, all had these various roles that we have played. We have all been both genders. Yeah, we have all been the various races in the world. We've all been rich and poor. We have all been educated and uneducated. We've all been disabled and not disabled. We've all been intelligent and not so intelligent. We've all been wise and foolish. Yeah, all of these things are there. They're all inside of us. And they've always been there. And because they are inside of us, eventually it will come out again, unless we make an end of this samsaric existence. And when you see all of these things inside of you, yeah, any kind of human being, or even beyond humans, even animals, even any kind of being that exists in the world, if all that potential is inside of you, you start to look at people in a new way. Yeah, because you are like them, they are like you. We aren't any different. And then how can you discriminate against anybody? Here the word discrimination is used a little bit differently, but you know, how can you discriminate? How can you not have the same care for anyone in this world as you have for yourself? How can you look at things? You start to see people in a way that is far more inclusive. And this is the beautiful way of seeing this. Because usually the only way that we can divide in the world is divide because we think I am better, they are worse. But you can no longer look at the world in that way if all of these things are already inside of you, just waiting to come out. It changes the perspective so dramatically. It's a beautiful way of thinking about the world. So this is the idea then of not discriminating, yeah, not really thinking of this. So we are not equal, but in a deeper sense, we are kind of equal, if you know what I mean. We are equal in the sense that we are, all of us are always changing, always moving around, always morphing into something else. In that sense, we are kind of on the same footing, yeah, in the same way. Anyway, so that is the idea of transcending discrimination, yeah, of kind of seeing beings as beings, seeing animals, even seeing yourself in animals, yeah, because that they too, we have been there many, many times before, whatever way it is, whatever being it is. And then when you abandon all of this I stuff, yeah, all this I that always is pushing us on, moving us around, which is also the source of craving because of the mind-making, well, then you are peaceful in a very profound sense, yeah? This is, again, typical of the Buddha. He said, yeah, then you are peaceful. Anything else doesn't really count. You have to become an arahant. Okay, then you are peaceful. That's kind of the understated. And you are well liberated, yeah? Full liberation of the mind. There's no kind of this annoying dukkha messing around with you. So that is the idea of non-self in what is suffering. Yeah, and you can contemplate this. We have already talked quite a lot about how to contemplate the suffering and unsatisfactoriness of the world. And you will start to, when you start to see that, you will understand that there's no point in having a self that is related to that. And the more you see the suffering of the world, the more acceptable that becomes. So then the Buddha goes on. If, when a bhikkhu, bhikkhuni, upasaka, upasaka often dwells with a mind accustomed to the perception of non-self in what is suffering. The mind is not devoid of eye-making, mind-making, and the conceit regarding this conscious body and all external objects. If it does not transcend discrimination and become peaceful and well-liberated, he should understand, I have not developed the perception of non-self in what is suffering. There is no distinction between my earlier condition and my present one. I have not attained the fruit of development. Thus he clearly comprehends this. But if, when he often dwells with a mind accustomed to the perception of non-self in what is suffering, his mind is devoid of eye-making, mind-making, and conceit regarding this conscious body and all external objects, and if it has transcended discrimination and become peaceful and well liberated, he shall understand, I have developed the perception of non-self in what is suffering. There is a distinction between my early condition and my present one. I have attained the fruit of development. Thus, he clearly comprehends this. When it was said, the perception of non-self in what is suffering, because when developed and cultivated is of great fruit and great benefit, culminating in the deathless, having the deathless as its consummation. It is because of this that this was said. So, there you are. That is what I was going to talk about in terms of right view, yeah, for now. So it's a lot about right view. Almost everything so far has been about that, except for one section where we talked a bit about virtue, morality, and those things. So a lot for you to contemplate. And I have done that specifically, spent so much time on it. We're kind of halfway through the retreat already, maybe slightly over halfway already. Goes so fast. Because right view is so important, this is the foundation of the Noble Eightfold Path, the first factor, the thing that kind of sets us going in the right way. This is the word of the Buddha, the vision of the Buddha that he bequeathed to the world so we can kind of inherit it and then carry it on in our own life. So it is like the foundation of everything, and because of that, it matters enormously. Right view is what makes everything else kind of go and work. Because you get the motivation, to practice the rest of the path when you see things in the right way. So very powerful. So there you are. But now we have the six other aspects of the sutta on all the defilements, the Sabbasava Sutta. We're going to look at the six other ways of giving rid of defilements. We've looked at the first one only so far, dasana pahatava, to be abandoned by seeing. And now we're going to look at the other six. And as you can guess, it's going to go quite a lot faster for these other six. The last one we're going to have a look at in quite a bit of detail because it is important, but the ones in the middle we're going to look at fairly quickly. Not going to spend too much time on them. We could, but the retreat is not long enough for that. So the next one here is now the defilements to be abandoned by restraint, to be given up by restraint. And this is a very standard formula that you find in the suttas, what is called the sense restraint formula. So we're going to look at that and discuss it fairly briefly. We could really discuss this at great length, but not this time. Again, every time is a bit different. But I'll hopefully discuss it enough to give you an idea of what is going on here. So this is what the Buddha has to say. What are the defilements that should be given up by restraint? Take a mendicant who, reflecting properly, lives restraining the faculty of the eye. For the distressing and feverish defilements that might arise in someone who lives without restraint of the eye faculty do not arise when there is such restraint. So the purpose here is to, again, overcome the distressing and feverish defilements. These are the asavas that we're talking about before, distressing and feverish asavas. Let me just have a look. I think feverish is, what is it, parilaha or something? Distressing asavas. Vigata parilaha, distressing and feverish parilaha, So it's about avoiding these things, to avoid them so you get them before they arise. That's kind of the point here. And so it starts off by saying, we're talking about restraint. This is kind of interesting. As I mentioned before, we have to be very careful when we hear words like restraint, because it sounds like we are supposed to use willpower and force and control the mind this way and that way. But then the very first word here is reflecting properly. Yeah? So this starts to give you an idea of what restraint actually means. It means not what you might think it might mean, which is the using willpower, but actually it means reflecting in the right way. The Pali word for reflecting properly is patisanka yoniso. So yoniso, yeah, like in yoniso manasikara, wise attention. Here we see that word again. This time it is wise reflection. Patisanka is like reflecting in the right way. Yeah, so wise reflection. So this is how you're restrained, by reflecting wisely. Kind of interesting, isn't it? So if we want to avoid bad mental qualities from arising, we need to reflect rather than hold them back. And if you think about it, it is quite obvious in some ways, yeah? Because if we can reflect our way out of bad qualities, if we can do that, then it is far less stressful, far less tiring than trying to always control these things by willpower. Yeah, willpower tends to sap our energy, and willpower is also not very good at overcoming defilements. If you use willpower and you try to kind of hold the defilements back, as soon as you let go of the willpower, they come back up again. Yeah, this is the problem with willpower. You hold it into place and bang, it comes out. It's like if you're angry, it's like a boiling kettle. Yeah, in the suttas, you have the idea of anger is being is compared to boiling water sometimes. Yeah, it is bubbling and boiling. Yeah? And if you try to kind of hold the lid down on the boiling kettle, it doesn't take long before it kind of comes back with a vengeance. And sometimes it's a bit like that. If you try to control your mind too much by willpower and force, actually sometimes it just comes back even worse afterwards. And you get really angry. When you get angry, you explode completely, absolutely out of control. It often doesn't work, and it tires you out, and you don't have any energy because you're not really overcoming it. So the idea of using wisdom instead is actually to turn your perception around so you no longer look at that object in such a way that it gives rise to anger. You see the object in a different way. You no longer look at the object in such a way that you start desiring it because you understand that there is a problem with that desire. So you change your perception. And this is called wisdom, yeah, when you change your perception in this way. And of course, the beauty of that is that when you change your perception and you see a person with loving kindness or compassion, instead of seeing their faults, you see the beauty in that person, you're not kind of suppressing the anger. What you're doing, you're changing your view in such a way it gives rise to the opposite feeling. Now you have compassion and metta instead, and the anger is completely abolished for long periods afterwards. So it is much more powerful. Yeah, it really gets rid of the defilement in a profound way. It's not just a matter of holding it into place. You are changing your whole attitude to what is going on. So this is why wisdom power is far preferable to willpower. And also you expend less energy, yeah, because you are using your wisdom. So what is the downside? Well, the downside is that it takes a bit of training to learn to see things in a different way. You have to apply yourself. Yeah, you have to persevere, commit to the practice. That is the downside. But it's not really a downside, it's just that you are developing your mind properly. So this is the idea. And there's another sutta which I usually mention on these kind of retreats, and this is the sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya 2, so I haven't included it here, but I'll just mention it briefly. And this is a sutta which talks about the two powers. So when the Buddha talks about two powers, well, then that means these are the things that we should use to empower our practice. What are those two powers? Patisankana bala, and bala means power in Pali, and bhavana bala. Yeah, patisankana is almost exactly the same word we have here. Here we have patisanka yoniso, patisankana, and patisanka is basically the same word. Yeah. So the power of reflection, and then the power of development. What are these two about? Well, the power of development is the power of meditation practice when you watch the breath and you enter samadhi and that sort of stuff. That's the power of development. It has to do with meditation practice. Everything else is the patisankana bala, yeah, the using the reflection to overcome your bad conduct by body, speech, and mind. It is reflection that you overcome bad conduct with, not willpower, not meditation. We don't meditate to overcome ill will and desires, yeah? We start meditating after ill will and desires have already been largely abandoned. There might be some very refined aspects left of these defilements, but nothing great, because if you have very powerful defilements in the mind, your mind will always be, the defilements will be in charge, and you won't be able to be peaceful. So you have to actually use the power of reflection to overcome defilements. And this is such an important thing. Nobody, this is not usually how people practice. People think that meditation is to overcome the negative and unwholesome states. Well, not really. It is reflection that is used to overcome negative and unwholesome states of mind. That's what it says, yeah, again and again. That is how you overcome it. Meditation is only used to overcome really refined unwholesome states. And then it is used to help you with insight down the track, but it is not used to the preliminary overcoming of these things. Kind of interesting, isn't it? I don't think many people in the Buddhist world really understand these things properly. Very rare to kind of to see this, but if you read the suttas, it's quite clear that this is what comes out when you read them carefully. So this is the context for this particular sutta of sense restraint. Yeah, this is how we have to think about this. So when you live restraining the faculty of the eye, yeah, because when you do that, when you restrain it, well, then these bad qualities, the fevers and distressing defilements, they don't arise because you restrain it. So how does this exactly work? Well, the way it works is that, you see something, yeah, or you hear something or whatever, and you can see that maybe some kind of defilement is about to arise. Yeah, you see a person who you may have having difficulties with or whatever, and you think, yeah, I've got to be careful, otherwise I might get irritated or upset or something, and you can see that this is about to happen. So that's the first thing, is that your ability to see this. This is the first part. This is difficult enough. And that seeing of it is all about mindfulness, yeah? Having enough awareness, enough presence of the mind to know what is going on. Yeah, ill will, maybe, is about to arise. Watch out, be careful. So mindfulness is the first aspect here. But mindfulness is not enough. If you are just mindful, you see, oh yeah, anger rising, anger remaining, oh yeah. Rage arising, and before you know it, you completely lost the plot and you have done something very stupid. So mindfulness is not enough. The second thing is then how to apply the mind to stop that anger from arising in the first place. Yeah, that is the second step. And that is where the wisdom faculty kicks in. It tells you how to look at that person in a new way. And we'll come to this later on in much more detail how to do that. But you already know the general idea. You look at the good aspects of that person, you remember those, or you have compassion for them because you know that they are their own worst enemy or something like that. That is the kind of general outline for how to do that. And then, because you're using your wisdom, then that defilement doesn't arise. The fever and distress of the defilements doesn't arise in your mind. This is how you do restraint, yeah? And it's very useful. It's extraordinarily powerful. Every one of you has the capacity to do that. Maybe not all the time, because in the hustle and bustle of ordinary life, things often happen so fast, before you know it, you are really upset about something, and it's kind of too late to stop it. But often we do have that capability of doing it. So do this, yeah? This is really kind of the core aspect of the Buddhist path, learning to perceive the world in the right way so as to overcome these very destructive emotions, especially anger. It is so destructive, yeah? So much of the violence and problems in the world arise from anger, destructive for our personal relationships, destructive for the relationship between nations, between everything, yeah? It is incredibly bad. And if you want to be have a happy and good life, one of the most important things you can do is to overcome this upset and anger that we carry around with us so often. So this is the yoniso, how to reflect properly or wisely in regard to the eye faculty. So you restrain it in this way by using wisdom and by being wise about how you deal with it. But of course, it's not just the eye, it is all the faculties who do the same thing. So reflecting properly or wisely, you live restraining the faculty of the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the mind. Yeah, even the mind. So again, same kind of ideas for the distressing and feverish defilements that might arise in someone who lives without restraint of the mind faculty do not arise when there is such restraint. Yeah, and then the summary verse there, for the distressing and feverish defilements that might arise in someone who lives without restraint do not arise when there is such restraint. These are called defilements that, something is gone a bit funny there. Okay, whatever. So maybe that. So we're going to have a look at things that are similar to this when we come to the second last of the defilements to be overcome, and that's to be overcome by, what is the second last one? One before development is dispelling, that's right, dispelling is the word. Okay, it's a kind of slightly funny word. Okay, dispelling, exactly. And when we come to that dispelling, we will look more, because dispelling and restraining is kind of similar, a similar kind of wisdom that you use. So we're going to look there in more detail about how to develop that wisdom. Look at some suttas that actually talk about this in greater detail. So we're going to get back to this more. But before we move on, I want to have a look at one more sutta that has to do with restraint of the faculties. And this is another sutta from the middle-length sayings of the Buddha. This is number 152, Indriya Bhavana Sutta, the development of the faculties. And this gives you a very similar kind of idea, a slightly different angle on the same problem. Yeah. So let's see what the Buddha has to say here. This is about the supreme development of the faculties. So now, Ananda, how is there the supreme development of the faculties in the Noble One's training? So Ananda was the Buddha's attendant for 20 years or so. So the Buddha often talks to him. He's often there, and he's often, remembering the suttas and passing them on to future generations. So how is there the supreme development of the faculties? So faculties here means the sense faculties, yeah, not anything else. So how do you develop these? Development here means developing the mind in such a way that the faculties are kind of under control. And the Noble One's discipline should be the Noble One's training. This is the Buddha's kind of training, yeah? The Dhamma and then the training which comes from that Dhamma. Here, Ananda, when a bhikkhu, a bhikkhuni, an upasaka, an upasika, the four assemblies, sees a form with the eye, there arises in them what is agreeable, there arises what is disagreeable, there arises what is both agreeable and disagreeable. Yeah, this is typically what happens when we engage the world through the senses. We like some of the stuff, we dislike some of the stuff, and some of the stuff is a bit of both. Yeah. So you understand, there has arisen in me what is agreeable, there has arisen what is disagreeable, there has arisen what is both. But that is conditioned, gross, dependently arisen. But this is peaceful, this is sublime, that is equanimity. So again, yeah, the reason I've taken this out, because this is a very similar kind of idea. This is also really about sense restraint, yeah, about not engaging in the wrong way with the senses. You understand that whatever arises through these five senses, you understand it in this way. It's conditioned, gross, dependently arisen. That is about using wisdom, yeah, in relationship to what is happening in the senses. So conditioned means that these things arise through cause and conditions. It means that you cannot control them. They come into being when the conditions are right, and then they pass away when the conditions are finished. You cannot have them. Yeah, that agreeable feeling is not under your control. Even the disagreeable feeling isn't under your control. They arise and come and go according to conditions. And of course, once you see that, you become far less interested in those things, because basically it is not something that you can have your way. This is a beautiful way of thinking about that sensory world. Sensory world is basically out of control. It comes into existence through its own cause and conditions. The second one is that it is gross. Yeah, the happiness and pleasure that comes through the world of the five senses, it just isn't that interesting. Yeah, the happiness is pretty kind of ordinary. It isn't all that, you know, a lot of the fun of the sensory world is often in the pursuit of these things. And when you get them, okay, actually it wasn't all that great anyway. There is far greater happiness is to be had, far greater satisfaction and contentment to be had by practicing the spiritual life. So you realize it's both out of control and it isn't all that great. Why am I bothering? Yeah, it's kind of madness to follow after these things. Yeah, just isn't really worthwhile. And the last one here is that it is dependently arisen. Well, again, this is very similar to the idea that it's conditioned. Yeah, it comes into existence through causes. The causes are there, then it arises, dependent on those causes. Then it comes into being, and then it passes away when the causes are gone again. The dependently arising of what is agreeable and disagreeable. Yeah, the suttas talk about this as when there is the I and the object coming together, and then eye consciousness arises. You have contact. Contact is experience. You experience that object. And feeling arises from that. It's like dependent origination. And then you experience the world. Yeah. But then your attention shifts, or the object disappears, or whatever. And then, of course, you will experience something else. Basically, it's out of control. The world just goes on according to its own things. And by understanding this properly, you have much less interest in that sensory world. And because you have less interest, you establish equanimity. Yeah, this is like the early equanimity, the equanimity in relation to the five senses. You're still in that world of the five senses, but you're no longer kind of going up and down, yeah, with that world. You're no longer, your mind isn't kind of being rocked around by these things, but you are more cool about it. You're standing back. You're gaining mindfulness. You have the ability to regulate your mind and not allowing yourself to be carried along by these sensory impressions all the time. In the previous sutta, they talked about the equanimity based on diversity. This is the equanimity based on diversity that you're seeing here. Yeah, it is the initial phase of moving outside of that world. And then from that, you then move on to the equanimity based on unity. Yeah, step-by-step thing. And that, of course, is even more profound. You can see again how the suttas have this integrity. They all kind of come together once you understand how to read them in the right way here. So that is just another way of using wisdom. Yeah, this is again wisdom power. Yeah, there's no willpower here. It's about using wisdom, understanding what is going on. And as you do that, you kind of let go of these things a little bit. Yeah, and then he says, he has this simile here. So first of all, the agreeable that arose, the disagreeable that arose, and the both agreeable and disagreeable that arose cease in him, and equanimity is established. Yeah. Just as a man with good sight, having opened his eyes, might shut them, or having shut his eyes, might open them, so too, concerning anything at all, the agreeable that arose, the disagreeable that arose, and both the agreeable and disagreeable that arose, ceases just as quickly, just as rapidly, just as easily, and equanimity is established. Yeah, so again, you have this kind of clarity about you, so just as quickly as you open your eyes and you kind of remind yourself and bang, the wisdom kicks in and you let it go. This is called the Noble One's training. In the Noble One's training, the supreme development of the faculties regarding forms cognizable by the eye. And then, of course, you have the other forms, the other senses as well, the ear, the tongue, the body, the nose, and the mind itself in exactly the same way. So I didn't comment on the idea of sublime there. You notice the word sublime is in there. Yeah, so you're moving away from the gross and dependently arisen phenomena arising in the eye and the feelings together with that, and you move towards equanimity. Equanimity is called sublime. Even just the ordinary equanimity that has to do with the senses is sublime compared to being rocked around by the five senses in the world. Instead, that coolness of the mind which stands back, yeah, and that, of course, is only the beginning of sublimeness, and sublimeness then gets taken to sublime levels. Sublimeness taken to sublime levels, that's kind of sublime squared, if you like. Okay, so there you are. That is the all for now. Again, please continue enjoying yourself, and we'll see you back again at 7 o'clock this evening here.